If you're an RIA, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com. A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at schwabvious.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
This is Hidden Killers Year in Review, a look back at the biggest stories of 2025. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Donna Adelson, well, she walked into court this week hoping to convince a judge that she was the real victim here. 75-year-old grandmother trapped in a jail full of violent criminals, denied proper medical care, and barely getting any sleep. There was a lot of sighs in her testimony. She said she was being assaulted, extorted, and suffering while awaiting trial. In other words, she was in jail. But the prosecution had a slightly different take on all this, one that involved jailhouse calls, escape plans, and an almost successful flight to Vietnam. But by the end of the hearing, Donna wasn't just staying behind bars. Her own words were now officially admissible at trial. Joining me to discuss is criminal defense attorney Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, wherever you get podcasts, also on YouTube, to break down exactly what went wrong for Donna in the courtroom. Let's get right to it. If you're a defense attorney, how do you even begin to spin the jailhouse call where your client is literally talking about escaping to a country with no U.S. extradition?
I mean, just like her lawyer did. I mean, you know, and she tried to sell the story. She's like, if I thought for 1 minute she was trying to escape, I never would have signed off on this motion. I never would have drafted it. You know, so I mean, like they came up with this concept that, oh, you know, Harvey and I had gone to Vietnam. We needed some peace. We were very upset, obviously. Charlie, our son, had just been found guilty and was going to prison. And you know, and I checked with, you know, people and there was no warrant for me. You know, I talked to the lawyer. They said, look, if there's nothing out there, you can do anything you want. You know, so I ended up booking the tickets because we had been to Vietnam previously and we found it to be a very harmonious, peaceful country and we really enjoyed it. So that's where we decided to go, you know, and now whether or not it just so happens that they have no extradition there, you know, and in the place that they were going to go to yes. After that had no extradition too. So,
And it's a talking point. It's not just like a, oh, really? I didn't know they had no extradition. It's like you're literally discussing it. So I'm going to guess it's kind of a selling point of that little trip there, you know, just in case you want to stay over a little bit longer. I mean, could this all have been avoided? I mean, why did she take the stand at her own bond hearing? I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the purpose of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think they needed her to get on in order to testify to the shit that was going on in the jail. You know, like, yeah. I don't know how else you get it in. Yes, it was written in the pleading, but that's not evidence in the case. That's just words on paper. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like we read pleadings all the time. People many times think whatever's in one side's pleading or the other is total bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the point of like you got to go in and vet it at court. So I can see why they did it. They came in. They obviously kept it to a very limited scope. You know, but it came off exactly how you think it would. Like she's a 75-year-old woman who hates being in jail.
Yes.
You know, like a bunch of like petty shit that a bunch of everybody in jail goes through. You know, yeah, the beds are not comfortable, Donna.
Yeah.
You know, people are mean in there. You know, you're dealing with some hardened criminals that are going to be in there. They're going to know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to know that you have money. They're going to come at you. I mean, it's kind of part of the deal, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the medical care is not going to be what you're used to. You got a wax buildup in your tough shit.
Yeah.
You know, you're spending $7,500 to have some high-end ENT guy like dig that shit out. Well, you're not getting that in jail.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, you're having a hard time hearing. Too bad. Get some Q-tips.
Yeah. You know, I mean, did you find any of her arguments of her care in jail or lack thereof to be viable or anything that really, you know, deserves a whole lot of attention?
No, I didn't. No. In all honesty, could that be because I'm covering the Richard Allen case so much, and
yeah.
I've seen what
real
pre-trial.
Yeah.
It makes it look like her shit's the pettiest shit I've ever heard in my life.
I agree.
You know what I mean? So, you know, like, and I realize that I could be looking at it from that perspective and being like, wow, like this, if she only knew.
Yeah.
You know, how bad it could really be. You know, but if I'm looking at it from a perspective of if she were my client and she were complaining of these things, I'd take the shot. You know, I'd take the shot. I'd write it up. I'd be like, all right, like, I don't want you to hold your breath on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the likelihood, because I don't think she's as much of a flight risk as she is a suicide risk.
Yeah.
I tend to think that, like, that would be my concern if I were the state. That, and I was frankly a little bit surprised that they didn't argue that.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of stuck with the flight risk. I mean, they've got her passport. Like, I don't know that Donna's going down to the boat docks and, you know, like paying somebody $5,000 to like stow her and Harvey away and bring them to Cuba. I mean, maybe she could do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're obviously going to be tailing her. She'd obviously have a GPS. And if she cuts it off, they're all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the concept of her, the flight risk thing is not that big to me.
Yeah.
The concept of her and Harvey just saying, she's like, dear, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you right now, like I got a little bit of a taste from this jail experience, like the concept of me living the rest of my life in a prison. I'm not willing to do it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do it. And I'm calling it a day, you know, because I mean, she can just look at her son's case
mm-hmm.
and know they're going to get her.
Yeah.
They're going to get her. You know, I don't see any world in which she's walking away with this. With the not guilty.
What are the biggest things you think they're going to get her on here? Because one of the biggest holes in this is that there's not technically direct evidence. There's not an email or a text or recorded conversation where Donna explicitly orders the hit. There is a check, but we don't have, you know, the exact smoking gun here. What are going to be the big points that they're going to hammer out here in court?
They're going to have to continue to build up the concept that Charlie didn't have cash liquid,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, because then the money can only come from one place. And the other thing that we know is that the money is going to be tracked. So it came from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So short of Donna and Harvey having a safe with just straight up cash, it was never accounted for. And these are all cash transactions. You know, maybe she's got a shot in kind of building some doubt that they don't have the proof. But I mean, otherwise it's, you know, you're putting on the case against Charlie in the sense that, well, Charlie was the middleman, you know, but she was the money man.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's no other way to look at this. You know, because I mean, a large amount of money was paid off
yeah.
to Meg Manabaugh, you know, and that's like, it came from somewhere. You know, I mean, that's what the case, like, they're probably, and, you know, frankly, we can't pretend that the, you know, the jailhouse calls and the overhears don't exist because,
no.
you know, she knew.
Yeah.
You know, they have enough to know.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not she was at the, you know, she was the puppet master, because really it's the same issue that they have with Wendy. mm-hmm. and probably to a greater extent, because I was having this conversation yesterday that, you know, the problem, like, there's no reason they need to be waiting for arresting Wendy if they have the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think secretly, and my buddy Jay, like, came up with this concept and it really resonated. He's like, you know what, I think that what the hope is from the state is that if Donna ends up getting convicted, that it's going to really, really piss Charlie off. And it's going to piss Charlie off to the extent, and the concept being that now him, his mother, potentially his father, who they may arrest next, he's still still very much in play.
Yeah.
You know, that every one of the family members is now either in prison or going to prison, and Wendy's living down in Texas eating fucking bonbons.
Mm-hmm.
That might be enough for Charlie to turn state's evidence and say, yeah, I'll give it up. I'm done with this shit. Like, we're all not going to, like, sit in prison while Wendy lives her life.
Yeah.
When we did this for her. So, you know, and it's like, it's going to be interesting. Like, what is Charlie going to say to protect his mom? I think Charlie will probably go to the mat
mm-hmm.
protecting his mom, you know, which is a very tricky thing because he's got appeals.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like how he's put in an impossible position where he's going to really have to go up there and continue to deny everything, you know, because he can't submarine his own appeal, you know, if it's still his contention that he didn't have anything to do with this, that, you know, that they all got whatever Rashbaum's theory was, you know, that they were getting extorted, you know? And so, yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I think the lesson that you take away from this is, you know, you look at the irony that she'd be willing to move to Tallahassee now, but wasn't willing to do it back when Dan was alive. You know, you want to be near your grandkids, and go fucking move near your grandkids.
Yeah, that's up to you, at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't kill the father.
No, you don't necessarily force them to have to go move back where you are. That's right. Your kids move out and they move on and they go on with life. If you'd like to be close to them, that's on your job at that point in time.
Exactly.
And you live with the consequences of that choice. If Charlie were to turn, how would that, I mean, obviously, we got the appeal issue here. Let's say he waits to turn. Would he wait till he can run those out? I mean, if he fails at all of them, and it's like, well, I guess I got nothing to lose now. And what sort of a benefit, would there be a benefit to Charlie if he were to turn and just kind of go state's witness on Wendy? Would that affect his sentence? Would that be something that would be looked at, or would that be more so to help try and save mom more than anybody else?
I think it would probably be a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
I have to believe that they have gone to Donna's attorneys and Charlie's attorneys and said, just give us Wendy. Mm-hmm. Like, if you work with us on Wendy, we'll do everything we can to go in and get you resentenced and shave some time off that. You know, they're probably making the same type of promises to Donna.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
you know?
But as far as Charlie goes, I mean, like, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road from the state's perspective, is he going to be willing to submarine his appellate chances by turning state's evidence, or is he going to wait to play it out? Because mm-hmm. I just, like, the case against Wendy, at least from what we know, I mean, they certainly have some circumstantial evidence. She's mm-hmm. driving by the crime scene, like, right as it's happening. It very much seems to be that she was in the know. That's, again, another amazing coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know if they have enough. If you get 12 people in a jury box that really know nothing about the Adelson case, and you're just putting on the evidence, you know, and I mean, you're going to have... Like, you're at that point, you're relying on the fact that common sense dictates that there's no way that Wendy's mother and brother are going through all of this shit and it's not at her behest.
Mm-hmm.
Because who benefits the most?
Exactly.
Donna getting to see her grandkids every once in a while? Yeah. I mean, sure. But her daughter not having to deal with Dan Markell anymore, I guess, is what, you know, so, but that's really, you know, it's a highly circumstantial case against Wendy.
Yeah. I mean,
they really need one of them to flip, unless they have, like, cause that's what I'm saying. If they had powerful evidence, if they had any text messages between Wendy and Charlie or Wendy and mom or WhatsApp or whatever, if they had any kind of communications where she's inculpating herself or showing that she had knowledge, I don't see why they'd be waiting. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I think as far as Donna went, like Charlie was the, you know, he was the test case.
Mm-hmm.
We have to, like, because it's like we've got to run this thing by a jury and see how it plays out. And if they're receptive, then we feel very comfortable about moving forward on Donna and then potentially Wendy. But, you know, it's, we'll see how it plays out. It's just it's a jacked up story.
And yeah. It's so, I mean, it's like they've been kind of just picking them off one by one. Obviously we did see Donna on the stand, and that was interesting. Do you think she takes the stand in the actual trial? Is that a good idea from a legal perspective?
I don't know. I never think it's a good idea for the defendant to take the stand. Like, even if they're innocent, it's so easy to have something that you say being misconstrued, especially if there's enough circumstantial evidence that exists, which typically if it's gone to trial, there's going to be some things that exist that look, if looked at in the right context, look shady.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't make it all the way to trial with there being no direct evidence and no substantial circumstantial evidence. So, you know, and then even if you're innocent and they like, but you're weighing it against this circumstantial evidence that they have, like, oh, well, you wrote this big fat check. What was that for, Donna? For the TV repairman? Yeah, sure, pal. You know, like the whole Harvey's birthday thing, like all these little things that are going to come out, you know, when she gets up there, you know, and she says one thing that just does not jive, you're done for up there.
Yeah.
I mean, if they get the sense that you're full of shit at any point during your testimony, you're done.
Yeah.
You know, because if they figure if you're lying about that, you're lying about all of it.
Yeah. She just struck me. I mean, without even, if you didn't know anything about the case and you just watched her testimony, she doesn't come off as a likable person. She comes across as that, you know, narcissistic grandmother or mother that everybody knows, someone who is like that. That's just the victim of everything, and everything is so hard.
Privileged, so privileged.
Yeah. And just so, you know, just completely into themselves without any sort of, you know, recognition of anything else around her. That, and it's sickening, especially if you recognize that those type of people in your life and you're like, oh, she's one of them. I mean, and it's to an extreme. And I do not see her coming across as the frail grandmother that's just been victimized here. She does not pull that at all.
I agree. And I mean, look at that bond hearing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was the perfect example of exactly what you're saying. Everybody that is in that facility is going through the same shit, and she's getting on the stand sniveling about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it just makes her look like an entitled, narcissistic, wealthy old bag.
Yeah. Who would very likely do something like this. I mean, just, well, if I can't have it, then I'm going to take care of it this way. And that's, she doesn't have to say that. You just, I mean, and it's, you don't want to put words in somebody's mouth or anything, but that's just, that's the aura that she gives off. Right. And it's so toxic. I was,
you
very
answered your own question. That's why you don't put her on the stand.
I know,
she oozes that shit.
Why did they already, I mean, they had to know what she was going to be like on the stand, and they put her up
well,
there.
Maybe not. Now they don't.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe in coaching, she was very, very, just very
sympathetic.
She came across as like B. Arthur or something. Well, that, B. Arthur's probably not a good example. B is kind of like her.
Yes, Aunt B from the Andy Griffith Show. Yeah. That's who you're hoping.
Yes, that's what you want. Or Betty White. That sort of.
Yes.
Get a Betty White up there, and then it would work. But yeah, you don't want B. Arthur on the stand.
No, you don't want, you know, because that's basically who you have.
That's what you have right now. That's a good. A good point to make there.
How do you think the defense is going to try and poke holes into the prosecution's argument that Donna funded the murder or didn't fund the murder when you have the check, when you have, you know, the drop off, you have all that stuff? I mean, how are you going to say that she didn't know what the hell she was doing?
Right. Well, I mean, you've got to come up with a viable explanation of where the money went.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, like, there has to be, like, whatever they're tendering to the state in discovery, which they would have to tender if they have the ability to rebut their evidence with financial statements. But, like, I mean, you have to know they've gone in, they've dug in, they have all of her financials. Mm-hmm. They have all of her, like, Harvey's financials. Like, the real thing is like, how much is there? Mm-hmm. Like, we only heard about the one.
Yeah.
You know, does there exist more? You know what I'm saying? Like, when they finally went in and arrested Donna, you know, that I'm sure the next step was that they went and got a search warrant for the house.
Mm-hmm.
When you get the search warrant for the house, you're then getting into their safe.
Yeah.
And you're finding out if they have a massive amount of cash piled up in there. Because then if you're the state, you're making the argument, well, okay, she only wrote the one check, but, you know, during the search of her home, she had $350,000 cash piled up in her safe. You know what I mean? Like, so for the defense, I mean, you're just going to have to say, but what evidence do you have that she paid it?
Yeah.
That's how you attack it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're saying, well, them's just words that the state's saying.
Sure.
That's not evidence. They need proof that the money came from Donna, went to Charlie, and then went to Katie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, they have to prove it up.
Yeah.
Like, so, I mean, you're really here. I am certain, or shouldn't say anything in this case about being certain, but I'm guessing that they're not going to go with the whole strategy of the money got paid as an extortion thing again. Mm-hmm. But I mean, because that is a thing.
And
he was all in on it, man. Like, I mean, in terms of the defense, he was like, man, like, I think this is what happened type shit.
Yeah.
Like, I believe it. Like, he was really trying to sell it. And, like, if you're Donna's attorney, I mean, that attorney doesn't strike me as one who's going to be willing to put forth that defense, which leaves you with that question. I mean, as bizarre and kind of ridiculous as that defense was, at least it was an explanation of why money.
It's a defense of some sort. Yeah,
if they're not going to do that, yeah, you know, like, she's going to have to come up with some other explanation.
Yeah,
which I don't know what it is.
Or is she going to take a plea deal? Are they going to offer a plea deal of, like, look, we'll give you 20 years, and, you know, maybe you'll be 95 when you get out? I don't know.
I mean, like, that. Like, I'm telling you, Donna wants to call it a day.
Yeah,
like she, like, the concept of what she was living, you know, the entirety of her life to what she's living now.
Yeah,
you, and, like, who she is, who we know her to be from watching and listening to her and hearing about her, dude, she is in hell.
Yeah,
in her mind, for her, she is in absolute hell. Because I am typically of the mindset that we as human beings can adapt, no matter how shitty the situation is. We adapt, you know, like, you get used to it. Like, we just like, Donna will never get used to it.
No.
Like, Donna, like, you know what I mean? I think that, like, I don't even know if she'd take a deal, if they offered her a deal, just on the off chance that she can beat it, that she's willing to take that risk.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, because at this point, I'm sure they've made the offer. Because the longer that Georgia Kappelman has to prepare for this trial, the less likely it is that deal stays on the table, if there is one.
Sure.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's game over for Donna in pretty much every way imaginable, it seems.
And, yep.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Can't wait to watch.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Divorces are ugly. Even the most amicable ones are a mess of paperwork, lawyer bills, and awkward holiday negotiations. But Dan Markell and Wendy Adelson's divorce? That wasn't just ugly. It allegedly was a full-blown war. Dan Markell was a Harvard-educated law professor, a legal scholar with a razor-sharp mind and a reputation for being uncompromising. He wasn't the kind of guy to let things slide. Wendy, on the other hand, allegedly was a rising academic in her own right, an attorney, and a writer, by all accounts. When they first met, they seemed like a perfect match, two brilliant legal minds. But as it turns out, two lawyers under one roof can be a dangerous combination in some cases. And by 2012, after 6 years of marriage and two young children, Wendy filed for divorce. Not just any divorce. This was the kind where every detail was a battlefield. Custody, property, money, control. But the biggest fight? Wendy wanted out of Tallahassee. She wanted to move back to South Florida, allegedly, where her family lived, where she would have financial support, childcare, and the life that she wanted. Dan, though, wasn't having it. He loved the kids, and he wasn't about to let them be taken 400 miles away. He fought Wendy's relocation request in court, and he won. A judge ruled that Wendy had to stay in Tallahassee with the children as long as Dan lived there. That ruling changed everything because for the Adelson family, Tallahassee wasn't just inconvenient, it was unacceptable. Wendy's family, her mother Donna, her father Harvey, and especially her brother Charlie, were not passive bystanders in this divorce. They were deeply involved in ways that most families, healthy families, wouldn't be or just shouldn't be. Donna Adelson, Wendy's mother, despised Dan Markell allegedly. She saw him as controlling, arrogant, and worst of all, an obstacle. She allegedly just didn't want her daughter and grandkids out of Tallahassee. She needed them out. She offered Markell money to let Wendy relocate. $1 million is what she offered. No, not just, hey, let me get you the U-Haul, $1 million. He refused, allegedly, because for Dan, this wasn't about money. It was about his kids. And to most people, that would be the end of it. The court had ruled, Markell had spoken, and Wendy had no choice but to stay. That's what happens a lot of times in divorce situations. But the Adelsons, they weren't the type to take no for an answer. This was a family that had resources, connections, and a lot of money. Suddenly, they had a problem that no amount of legal maneuvering seemed to solve. It was around this time, October of 2013, that Charlie Adelson did something interesting. Wendy had been actively looking for a new home in Tallahassee, trying to settle into her post-divorce life. But suddenly on October 31st, Charlie told her to stop. He told her not to buy a house in Tallahassee, allegedly. Now, at the time, that might seem like just another overbearing sibling trying to control things. Don't do this. I know better. You know, that all that stuff. But here's where it gets chilling. Because on October 31st, 2013, it's also the exact day that Charlie Adelson first inquired about hiring a hitman. So what does that mean? It means that before Wendy could even think about putting down roots in Tallahassee, before she could accept her new reality, Charlie was already exploring an alternative, allegedly. And Wendy, She either had no idea what was happening behind the scenes, or she did. It's one or the other. And the months leading up to the murder, things continued to escalate. In June of 2014, about a month before Markell was murdered, Wendy had a conversation with her then-boyfriend, Jeffrey Lacoste, that in hindsight sounds deeply ominous. According to Lacoste, Wendy was frustrated. She felt trapped in Tallahassee. And then she told him something that stuck with him long after Markell was dead. She said that her brother, Charlie, was considering options to solve her problem. That's an interesting choice of words, isn't it? Not helping me find a legal solution, not supporting me while I figure this out, but considering options. Then Lacoste asked what she meant, Wendy allegedly told him that Charlie had looked into hiring a hitman. Now, Lacoste didn't think much of it at the time. People say a lot of things and moments of anger and frustration, but after the murder, he remembered that conversation very differently. Because just weeks later, Dan Markell would be dead. That brings us to July 18th of 2014, the morning of the murder. We know what happened that day. We know that Markell dropped his kids off at daycare. We know he went to the gym. We know he pulled into his driveway around 11 a.m. Two hitmen hired by people connected to Wendy's family were waiting for him. We also know that minutes after the murder, Charlie Adelson and his mother, Donna, were on the phone with each other. But what about Wendy? Well, just 40 minutes after Dan was shot, Wendy did do something curious. She called Dan's phone. Now, on the surface, that might seem normal. Maybe she was just calling him about the kids. Maybe she didn't know yet. Or maybe, just maybe, she was checking to see if the plan had worked. Who knows? This is where things start to take shape. The motive is clear. Wendy wanted out of Tallahassee. Her family was desperate to make that happen. And just weeks before Markell was killed, Wendy said out loud that Charlie was looking into solutions. Now, maybe Wendy was just venting. Maybe she really thought her brother was joking when he said a hitman was cheaper than a TV. And maybe he was joking at that moment in time. But then maybe started thinking more about it later. Or maybe she knew what was coming. Nobody really knows right now, except for her. She's never been charged with anything as of now. And she is innocent of anything. She's never been charged with anything. And she's denied having any knowledge of these events going on. So, it's a lot of allegedly in this as we get closer and closer to Mom's trial date. Here's something else that got really curious. The day after Markell was murdered, Wendy finally got what she wanted. She packed up her kids, moved to South Florida, and never looked back. Like, boom. But was Wendy just an innocent beneficiary of this crime? Or was there something more? We know what happened next. We also know about the cover-up, the FBI sting, and the suspicious financial transactions that would eventually lead to arrests. And we know that Wendy somehow still has not been charged. So maybe she really does not know anything. It was quick. It was two shots, one to the head, another to the face, fired at close range when Dan Markell sat defenseless in his car. At exactly 11 a.m. on July 18th of 2014, the assassination of Dan Markell was carried out with chilling efficiency. The killer, Sigfrido Garcia and Luis Rivera, had trailed Markell all morning. They had watched him drop off his kids at daycare, followed him to the gym, and then waited as he made his way home. When he pulled into his driveway, the silver Toyota Prius they were driving blocked him in. Rivera stayed in the driver's seat. Garcia got out, walked up to Markell's car window, and pulled the trigger. A murder for hire, precise and brutal. By 11:06 a.m., Donna Adelson, Wendy's mother, was making a phone call to Charlie Adelson. This is where the web starts to unravel, because what happens next is not the behavior of an innocent family member learning about an unexpected tragedy. It's the behavior of people who maybe knew what was coming. Maybe. Charlie didn't answer his mother's call at 11:06, but at 11:22 a.m., just minutes after Markell had been shot, Charlie called Donna back. They spoke for 7 minutes. At 11:42 a.m., Wendy called Dan Markell's phone. Now, this is where you have to ask yourself, okay, why? Dan and Wendy were divorced. They weren't in the habit of casually checking in with each other. By this time in the day, Dan should have been back home alone, but instead his phone was ringing while he lay dying in his car just outside his house. It's a lot of questions that arise at that moment. There are only a few explanations. One is that Wendy was simply calling about something routine. That happens. Maybe about the kids, maybe to ask about pickup times or travel plans, you know, normal stuff. Or maybe she was checking to see if he'd answer. Because if he didn't, it might point to something. Meanwhile, something else was happening. A dark-colored Honda Odyssey minivan, a car that looked suspiciously like Wendy's, was seen approaching the crime scene just as police were beginning to block off the road. The driver stopped, saw the commotion, then turned around and left. Coincidence? Possibly. Or possibly not. By early afternoon, Tallahassee police were already knocking on Wendy Adelson's door. A high-profile law professor had just been shot in a quiet neighborhood. The first place you start a case like this is the spouse, especially when that spouse is locked in a bitter, ongoing legal battle with the victim. Wendy met them at her house and agreed to go down to the station for questioning. And this is where things get strange. Most people, when they sit down with police after learning their ex has been murdered, are in shock. They're confused. They have no idea what to think. They wait for the police to tell them what happened. Wendy? The moment she sat down, she floated the idea that her own family might be involved. No one had asked about her family. No one had suggested that anyone in her life had anything to do with this. And yet there she was, talking about it. And then came the part that would follow her for years, the moment when she casually mentioned that her brother Charlie had joked about hiring a hitman to solve her divorce problems. Yeah. Let's pause for a second. Imagine you're a detective sitting across from a woman who just found out that her ex-husband was assassinated in his driveway. You're not even an hour into the interview, and she's already talking about a murder-for-hire joke her brother made that very morning. That's not normal. That's not anywhere close to normal. But Wendy did seem to realize how it sounded. She downplayed it. As if it was just dark humor, just something Charlie would say. But here's the thing. People who aren't involved in murders don't usually bring up murder-for-hire jokes within hours of the crime. So was Wendy getting ahead of the story? Was she trying to explain away something she knew might come up later? Or was this just an incredibly unlucky coincidence? Maybe, you know, sometimes you do have inclinations about what you fear people may do. And maybe that fear is what became a reality, and she was just trying to learn to accept it without looking as if she was truly involved. Just had a fear that maybe Charlie and Mom might cook something up. But they never went to her about it. Could that be the case too? By the time the sun set that evening, Dan Markell was dead. His ex-wife had been questioned and released, and now the Adelson family was moving fast. The very next day, when he packed up her two sons and left Tallahassee for South Florida, never moved back. But again, you got to think of it. You just have this trauma happen in your life, and you have two kids that now have to understand that you're never going to see Dad again. And if you have nothing to do with this, you probably want to go to family. Assuming you don't know that your family did this. Or it could work the other way if you did know. The optics, either way, aren't great, but they make sense. Dan Markell had fought tooth and nail to keep his children from being taken away from him. He'd won that battle in court, but now he was gone. Just like that, the custody battle was over. The next few months were full of quiet, calculated decisions. Wendy cut off all contact with Dan Markell's parents. She changed her children's last names from Markell to Adelson. She quit her job at Florida State University and never returned to teaching. One fell swoop, she had completely severed her old life, and then there were the finances. Well, Wendy's hands never directly touched the money that paid for the hit. The cash started flowing. Charlie Adelson, the alleged mastermind, funneled tens of thousands of dollars to Catherine McBona, the woman who connected him to the hitman. A used Lexus, a job at the Adelson family dental practice where she didn't actually work. Big chunks of cash handed over in a way that suggested this wasn't just about romance. It was about hush money. Meanwhile, a phone record showed that the Adelsons were still talking constantly. Wendy, Charlie, Donna. Charlie was calling McBona. McBona was calling the hitmen. And yet, through all of this, Wendy never seemed to directly touch the crime. She never sent the texts, never made the calls. She never moved the money. So the question is, was that by design? Was she deliberately kept out of the paper trail? Or was she truly just an unlucky bystander in a crime that happened to make her life a whole lot easier? Is it a combination of it all? 2 years passed before the first arrests were made. In 2016, the killers were finally taken into custody, Sigfrido Garcia and Luis Riviera. The case was breaking wide open. The same year, the FBI decided to test the Adelsons. They sent an undercover agent to approach Donna Adelson, pretending to be someone who knew about the murder. He handed her a note demanding cash. This was the moment. If Donna was innocent, she would have gone straight to the police. Instead, she called Charlie. Charlie then immediately called Catherine McBona. And the next time Charlie and Donna were in a room together, they were caught on tape discussing the situation in ways that suggested they weren't just innocent bystanders. But through all of this, Wendy remained untouched. She wasn't in the wiretap. She wasn't in the money transfer. She wasn't in the recorded conversations. Leaves us with two possibilities. Again, either she truly didn't know what was happening behind the scenes, which is where it appears to stand now. As like I said, no charges have ever been brought against her. I actually seriously wonder if this was all done without her having knowledge, but just kind of having that inkling like, oh shit, I know my family and they will get what they want. But also, I don't know. I don't know. Or she knew enough to stay out of it. That's a question that has haunted this case for years. Was Wendy just a lucky recipient of her family's crimes? oh, oops, all this happened. Gee, I'm glad your life is going to be much easier now, and you're going to be here because we want the kids down here. Or was there something more? Because one thing is for sure, while the rest of the Adelsons were scrambling, trying to cover their tracks, Wendy just walked away. Walking away doesn't mean you get away with it. And as we're about to see, the walls around the Adelson family were starting to close in. If this case were playing out in a movie, Wendy Adelson would have been arrested long ago. The bitter divorce, the custody battle, the suspicious comments, and the fact that the hit gave her exactly what she wanted. It all adds up to a story that feels obvious. But this isn't a movie. It's a real world where prosecutors don't just need a story, they need evidence. And that's why, despite everything, Wendy Adelson is still free. Because when it comes to proving a murder conspiracy in court, suspicion isn't enough. You need a smoking gun. And so far, no one has found one. Doesn't mean the case against Wendy isn't compelling. It is. The timeline alone raises serious questions. The hitman joke, the phone call to Dan Markell just minutes after the shooting, the immediate relocation, the name change, the severing of ties with Dan's family. It all paints a picture of someone who at best, I don't know, is acting kind of suspicious. But did she know more than she admitted? Legally, that's just not enough. Unlike Charlie and Donna, Wendy was never caught on wiretap discussing the crime. She wasn't part of the FBI's undercover sting. There's no recorded conversation where she talks about money being moved or making sure someone is kept quiet. Her name never appears in any payments. She never called the hitman. She never texted anyone about the plot. And that creates a problem for prosecutors if they're looking at her. And believe me, they've looked. Because in a case like this, you don't just need circumstantial evidence. You need to prove intent. You need to prove that Wendy knew the murder was going to happen, agreed to it, or actively participated in the planning. And right now, they can't prove it. And like I said, they've looked. Anything you could look at that exists has been examined. Part of the reason Wendy remains untouched is because of a calculated move by the prosecution. They also gave her immunity. Now, let's be clear on this. This wasn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. It was use immunity, which means that nothing she said on the witness stand can be used against her. It does not mean that she can never be charged. It just means that if prosecutors wanted to indict her, they have to do it with things that were not within her own words. They can't use her own words against her from whatever she testified to at that time. And that complicates things because Wendy testified at multiple trials. She was questioned about the hitman joke, about her family's disdain for Markell, about the way she immediately relocated after his death. She was pressed about why she told police her own family might be involved and why she casually dropped that hitman line into the conversation. And she stuck to her story. She did not crack. She did not slip up. She never admitted to knowing anything. And since her words were protected by immunity, prosecutors have to build a case without them if they ever want to go after her. But is there anything to go after her with? Should they even have to go after her? Is this all exactly what she claims it is? An overzealous family that went out and did her bidding without her even asking them to do so. What else do they have? If Wendy's ever going to be charged, it will likely come down to one thing, a co-conspirator flipping. Because right now, the only people who truly know whether Wendy was involved are the people who planned the murder. Charlie. Allegedly Donna, maybe even Harvey, if anything happens there. But he's never been charged with anything either. So far, there's no evidence that points to
Harvey or Wendy knowing anything about this. It's a hard one to swallow, though, isn't it? Charlie, even after being convicted, hasn't implicated Wendy. Donna, even after being arrested, hasn't said a word. And if no one talks, prosecutors may never get the piece of evidence they need to move forward. But again, you don't need it if it doesn't exist. But here's where things get interesting. With Donna's trial coming up, the stakes for her could not be higher. She's in her 70s. She's facing life in prison. And if she sees no way out, will she start talking? If she does, and if she implicates Wendy, then all bets are off. Because the moment one of the co-conspirators confirms that Wendy knew all about the hit before it happened, that's the moment prosecutors could finally move, if that, in theory, ever happens. If it's even possible, if it's even true. Because right now it's an allegation. And that might be exactly what they're waiting for. While the prosecution waits, the public has already made up its mind. Because in the court of public opinion, many think Wendy Adelson had something to do with this. Maybe not pulling the trigger, maybe not hiring the hitman herself. But allegations that she might have knew something. Guilty of benefiting. Guilty of walking away from a murder that gave her exactly what she wanted. And that perception does matter, even if it's flawed, even if it's not true. Because every time someone else in the case gets convicted, first the hitmen, then McBonough, then Charlie, it adds more pressure for Wendy to maybe be next. Or does it end now with Donna? But the pressure can only go so far, because if the state charges her and loses, that's it. They don't get a do-over. They don't get to try again. Double jeopardy would apply, and Wendy Adelson would be untouchable, which means prosecutors have to be sure. They can't afford a weak case. They can't afford a miss. So where does this leave us? Right now, Wendy is free. She's still in South Florida, still raising her kids, still living a life untouched by the legal consequences that have swallowed many other members of her family. That doesn't mean that she's not safe from ever being prosecuted, because this case is far from over. And with Donna's trial on the horizon, with every piece of evidence that comes out, with every new conviction, the walls are closing in. If prosecutors get what they need, if somebody does talk and implicates her, then Wendy Adelson's day in court might still be coming. If that day comes, she won't have the luxury of walking away this time. What do you think? Tell us in the comments section. If you're watching us on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, check us out on YouTube. And you can watch all of our podcasts as we do them, and comment as well. Lots of great folks in there discussing these cases right now. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading podcasts. You don't miss any of the stories that we continue to cover for you right here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.